My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. My fellow plebs, today's podcast is also brought to you by Moon Mortgage. As the world moves increasingly towards the mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage makes it possible to materialize your assets into real estate. Through the collateralization of mortgages with Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage will be launching lending solutions to allow investors to easily leverage their assets to purchase investments in owner-occupied property. Moon Mortgage's crypto mortgage will be launching soon for home buyers in Texas, Florida, and Colorado, and will also be open to investors in most states across the U.S. for investment properties. Welcome to the future of mortgages. Visit moonmortgage.com today to register and learn more. Moon Mortgage Residential is registered with the NMLS under number 235334. Today's episode is brought to you by Gordon Law Group. If you've tried to do Bitcoin taxes yourself, you know how complicated it is. You can spend hours and hours going through your transactions and researching tax forms, and you're still not sure if it's right or if the IRS will come after you. Or maybe you're so intimidated by Bitcoin taxes that you don't even know where to start. Gordon Law Group can help. Ditch the spreadsheets and feel confident with a bulletproof Bitcoin tax return. They can help with IRS payment plans, and they also provide a full range of legal and accounting services for Bitcoin and digital asset startups. Get your taxes done right the first time with the original Bitcoin and digital asset tax pros. Go to GordonLawLTD.com/BTC. As a bonus, they'll send you the ultimate Bitcoin tax guide for free. That's GordonLawLTD.com/BTC.
Yo, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bitcoin.
Good morning.
How y'all doing?
Not too bad. Yeah, no real complaints. It's a beautiful Friday morning.
Grant, Amanda, have you guys caught up on sleep after the big event you just threw?
Amanda, I don't know about you, but yeah, that was my plan for last weekend. The funny thing about events, and you all know this, right, with Coin Miami, is like it almost feels like the real work starts like the week after, right? Because there were just so many amazing people in the audience. Like Amanda and her team met with literally like dozens of offices the day after. And, you know, you put in all this work and it happens on event day and you're really proud of it. But then if you don't capitalize on that momentum, you know, you can lose out on so much of the benefit of doing the event itself. So in a weird way, it's like some of the work's just getting started. But Amanda, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm awesome. I'm just honestly trying to make tea right now and I'm visiting my family. So taking a little break and I cannot figure out these tea makers or these kettles. So that is my challenge right now. But yeah, you're right. We have a lot of follow-ups, which is amazing. I'm pretty stoked about I feel like a lot of offices that I wasn't expecting for them to start, you know, kind of getting this or starting to. So definitely a lot more optimistic than the week before the event. So that's awesome. So nice work. Cause I think, you know, some of them had attended your event, Grant, and then some of them had, you know, heard of it. So good job. It was really important you did that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being a part of it.
So Amanda, you kicked us off with an interesting statement. You're making tea this morning and not coffee. Is that an active, you know, choice? Are you pro tea, anti coffee? Tell me more.
I'll have coffee sometimes, like when I'm desperate or like camping. It's definitely more of like, I love the smell of it, but I think I have a little bit of like deep British roots that forced me to tea still. So I just like tea more.
Fair enough. Well, I'm pouring myself a cup of coffee right now. So you're hitting my vibes. All right. Well, so Anna, I don't know if we want to jump into.
I know we only have Amanda for the first 45 minutes or so. So I just wanted to get it started. I mean, a lot going on the news, a lot's happening. And I guess the first and the biggest question is, at this point, what does our country need to do to not push out all the Bitcoin companies and innovators out of the US?
I think this is like something that really hits home for me. I know Jack Mahler's, like myself, Senator Lummis, you know, we kind of alluded to that and or just directly said it on stage. So I hope that, you know, that came through loud and clear. You know, that's something we've been saying in meetings for years, is, you know, for us to remain globally competitive, we need to have, you know, not push this industry out, to keep our best and brightest, because at this point, you know, this is a global industry, especially mining from my side, and we will just leave. You know, it's pretty simple. So I think that very honest, you know, conversation one-on-one has been helpful with staffers, because they're like, you'll just leave. And we're like, that's what this, you know, every mining left China within 6 months, the hash rate was pretty close to where, you know, where it was when they banned mining. So being able to like point to things like that and help them realize that, you know, if they want to keep the best and brightest here, and if they want to be the most innovative in the world still, then we've got to make room for this and put differences aside. So we focus a lot on, you know, bipartisan connecting offices across the aisle as well, which, you know, you have to know their personalities and their history and context pretty well to be able to do that. But I think that's been helpful, is the bipartisan connections and just being very confident and we're not, you know, being dramatic or lying, or we're just saying we will leave. And it's pretty simple, because we will. So I think that, you know, that transparency and, you know, is something they're not used to. So that helps a little bit as well.
Yeah, there's probably not many industries out there that have advocates who are really just advocates that the industry stay in the US, not that the industry like continue to exist, right? Like, it's kind of an authentic, different flavor than what they're used to, I'm sure.
Yeah, so hopefully memorable, you know, that's kind of part of why we do that in a very like gentle but sincere manner. I think it's important they realize like that's the direction the world's going with all technology. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, recognizing that, you know, in some ways, like the Bitcoin industry is unique, but in other ways, it's a representative of like broader, you know, trends around just like the global talent pool, essentially. And the idea that businesses, you know, no longer have to domicile in the US, you know, unless they really want to, or unless there's some like kind of strategic reason for them to do so. It's not just like, oh, if you want to be a $1 billion startup, you have to be in the US, right? I mean, look at India, for example. Just like over the past 18 months, they've just been like producing, you know, unicorn startups left and right. And so, you know, what we're realizing is, yeah, like if you want to build a successful company, you don't actually have to be in Silicon Valley anymore. You know, if you want to work in like the banking sector, yeah, New York is still the hub, but there are a lot of successful fintech companies that are not in New York or Chicago or some of these places. And so, you know, Bitcoin, obviously, because of something like mining being, you know, geographically agnostic in many ways, being able to go, you know, wherever energy's cheapest, I think the same ethos can be found in the industry broadly. And that is pretty new, right? That is pretty new for the US to have to deal with like true global near instantaneous competition when it comes to talent, when it comes to where people are going to, you know, bring their companies. And I guess to answer your initial question of like, what do we need to see? I think as tough as it is like to say this, you actually like do need to, the U.S. needs to feel some pain before they're really going to get this. At least that's my take. And it doesn't need to be like, you know, earth shattering, you know, not all the companies need to leave, but there do need to be, you know, more examples of what, you know, someone like Coinbase is doing, which is not just saying, hey, we're going to leave if you don't, you know, give us what we want or what we need, but like actually doing it, right? Because at a certain point, you know, talk is cheap. And I think, you know, once the U.S. starts to see, oh, you know, $1 billion company is no longer doing business here. And I think once they grapple with this idea that, you know, it's not just turning an offer on, it's either here or somewhere else. And I think shifting the framework of like consumer protection to, all right, if we really care about consumers, and if we really do believe in like doing what's best for people in the U.S., then it's going to be better and safer, you know, to have companies here in the U.S. than it will be to push them, you know, offshore and actually increase the risks for consumer harms.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good point. I hadn't yet kind of thought of the Coinbase move as a, you know, look at what you're making me do kind of move, just as like a political statement. That's interesting. You know, I'm curious, like a lot of what you guys just talked about was, you know, keeping the industry here. Do you see a scenario where like the industry leaves the U.S., but it doesn't affect kind of the user base in the U.S.? Because I know that the user base of Bitcoin, you know, obviously, I think the U.S. is still the largest market. I know there's a couple that are growing quickly, but what do you see in terms of kind of regulation and policy making that would potentially harm kind of American users from being able to use Bitcoin?
I think the on and off ramps and the banking situation is probably the area where we're the most vulnerable right now. So if we cannot, you know, move our fiat into, you know, River, Strike, or Swan, or whatever it is, that's going to be a problem, right? At an individual level, if our banks start, you know, at a greater level, because I've heard this happens before, stopping those transactions. And I feel, you know, the more that the banks collapse and condense, you know, the more vulnerable that is, especially as JP Morgan's kind of taking more and more of these banking clients. So I'd say, you know, for each of us, maybe it's important to have redundancy in bank accounts and have like a, maybe, you know, for me, I'll say have a like community bank account personally, and then a bigger one, right? And so having ability to move, you know, move funds into Bitcoin, I think is one of the biggest risks. That's a huge risk for any Bitcoin company or miner as well. So that is something when we're going into offices, we speak about that a lot. You'd be surprised at how many staffers, they say, wait, you're being debanked. Like they have no idea, right? So I think us telling those stories from a business level is really important. And then being able to protect that right to, you know, transfer funds how we want to as Americans is really important.
Yeah, the unfortunate reality is like with anything else in the world, you have to follow the money. And due to that, my view is that the industry and the direction of U.S. regulation are going to be fundamentally intertwined. And by that, I mean, if more of the industry is in the United States, and the United States has, you know, a further vested interest in embracing this industry and, you know, providing like muted regulation and encouraging its citizens to use this technology. If this industry is outside of the U.S. and it's no longer inherently beneficial for U.S. users to be using this technology, then I am a lot less optimistic about how the U.S. is going to approach regulation with regards to the space. And so I guess in very real terms, right, if, you know, the majority of hash rate moves offshore, and if the largest exchanges are offshore, and if the, you know, best and brightest upstart, you know, Bitcoin lightning companies are, you know, starting in Europe or India or somewhere that's not the U.S., then I am pretty bearish on, you know, how Treasury is going to look at this technology, you know, how the OCC, FDIC, Fed are going to view like safety and soundness when it comes to this technology. So that is a big reason why I think a lot of the times these things get muddled in some ways. You know, we end up talking about the industry while we're talking about the technology, but I think it's because when you just think about the heuristics that lawmakers are thinking through, they're looking at, in many ways, like it's easier to think of this as like, you know, a new startup ecosystem, at least as a first layer. And using that framing, I think is helpful in kind of helping lawmakers understand what they can do to help an industry like, you know, flourish or thrive. I think it's a little bit harder, you know, as you kind of abstract it out from there.
So, you know, to kind of double click on something you guys were talking about, right? This debanking trend. I know it's been talked about kind of to death in you know, the Twitterverse and the Bitcoin kind of community. Nick Carter's been one of the people really raising the flag on it. I'm curious, like, what do we do about that? Like, you guys are kind of the ones who are working in DC and working with regulators. You know, call me like a Karen who's looking to talk to the manager. Like, who do I need to talk to stop this from happening? Because it seems like it's happening and I'm not really even sure where it's coming from.
Yeah, this is huge. And I think that's where it's nice. Sometimes things can be simplified by looking at committees and looking at the, you know, for us, we look at the Senate and House committees that work on banking or financial services. We met with the Financial Services Committee and, you know, we're giving very specific, you know, examples and had, you know, a couple publicly traded company representatives in the room, you know, a humanitarian person. We try to bring different perspectives and they were taking the most rigorous notes I've seen in a long time. And so I think there's, you know, pushback right now, especially there's some momentum with pushback with the SEC for many things, some overreach with, you know, questions they're sending companies and requests. And then on the banking side, there was, like I said, such a lack of awareness that people or that companies are being debanked. I think we need to keep telling that story because we can yell it into the ether of the Twitterverse, but it really doesn't matter. You know, if we're not sending specific examples and people that are being debanked are showing up in these offices, I think when you meet in person and look at people in the eyes and tell them this is what's happening, there's this like aha moment of this isn't some crazy anarchist. Like this is, you know, a former Fortune 500 executive that's telling me this. That starts to click in their mind a little bit of like, this is a very serious problem. And that's just, you know, I don't love that. I love that, you know, we have so many diverse entrepreneurs and I don't love that we feel the need to do this or like feel the pain to have to do this, but it's what seems to be helping at the moment.
So Amanda, you know, shameless plug, Patrick McHenry is coming to the Bitcoin conference in a couple weeks. He's the head of the Financial Services Committee in the House. Like, you know, if I were to walk past him in the convention hall and, you know, I got 30 seconds to ask him, like, what do you need to do? Is it like, do a committee meeting specifically about this? Is there a bill that needs to be passed? Do they need to bring in some of these bank CEOs and grill them? Like, what do you think the right thing that they actually need to do about this is?
Yeah, I think if we need to, it's a hearing with, you know, not with real people, real companies testifying. You know, there's like what's been happening in these committee hearings is you have these academics or people that have, you know, very not good interests with Bitcoin. And we aren't hearing like the real, those of us that are like building on this and work and using this, right? So I think that couldn't hurt. They can also do, you know, classes. There's all sorts of things that can be done at the committee level. So yeah, I would say that would be helpful.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
Here, if I could add quickly, I think the education part of this is incredibly important. I think it's also helpful just for the audience to understand the dynamics that we're dealing with here. I always like to differentiate between, you know, legislators and regulators, and, you know, notice how Amanda was talking about, you know, the House and Senate and the various committees that actually have, you know, oversight over these different regulatory bodies and, you know, or can pass laws that regulators ultimately have to enforce. But, you know, what we've seen with, you know, the debanking stuff is a lot of these actions are being taken by regulators either out in, you know, out in the open through public statement or behind closed doors. And regulators are not necessarily publicly accountable, right, in the same way or ways that legislators are. And so because of that, they're able to take, you know, certain actions that can, you know, really affect people or really piss people off. And you might not see as quick of, you know, a turnaround even with public outcry as you might see with lawmakers. And so that's where, you know, legislators ultimately can hold regulators in check. And, you know, things like what Congressman Warren Davidson have done, you know, writing, and he's not the only one, right, but writing letters, you know, to the SEC, to the CEA, to various, you know, executive agencies or executive departments, like that is valuable because it kind of puts agencies' feet to the fire. And ultimately, it's going to take a lot more of that because, you know, right now, the regulatory bodies are able to kind of act and not be held immediately accountable in the same way that legislators are. But, you know, Brandon, to answer your first question, it's early in the morning. I'm just going to be completely, like, blunt and honest here about if you're asking what could the industry do to kind of who do we need to talk to? How do we need, you know, change people's minds? I think it is very interesting, and I'll just leave it at that, that before FTX blew up, before it was exposed to be a $32 billion fraud, the White House was actually pretty, you know, agnostic to medium positive around crypto broadly. And I think it's interesting that, you know, SBF was one of the current administration's largest donors. And like I said at the beginning of this space, follow the money. Right now, the current administration doesn't see the value from its existing base and its existing donor base to support this industry. And it certainly doesn't see the value when you bring up a lot of the national security and consumer protection concerns that come along with that. And so I'm not the person to do it, but I think just like very bluntly, if whether it's the existing administration, and if you want to support the, you know, Biden's upcoming reelection campaign or another candidate or whoever it is, just like purely pragmatically, this isn't me promoting anything. I think, you know, a massive check from someone in the Bitcoin industry certainly, you know, cements a different perspective for that administration on how they're going to view this industry. And look, it's very easy at the end of the day for lawmakers to just like, and the current administration to throw this industry out or view it negatively if they just don't see the economic incentive to support it.
Yeah, I might throw something in because Grant brought up, thanks for differentiating between, you know, policymakers and regulators. The admins of the president's office, the administration, I know both of our groups, so Bitcoin Policy Institute, Grant, and then Bitcoin Today Coalition, you know, within a month of each other, we had two separate meetings with the office of the OSTP from the White House and warned about, you know, specific in the report they were building about, you know, about the energy usage and digital assets, I think is how they labeled it. We both gave them like very specific, you know, data that was from the industry. We, I believe, both kind of warned them about some of the false numbers that have been disproven by some of our favorite, you know, favorite antagonists in this with us and Arnold on our little hero's journey. But it definitely to me seemed like the administration had an agenda from the beginning. So it wasn't, to me, it's like not an office of science, right, at this point. And so we have to understand like what we're dealing with. One thing that I kind of do love on the presidential side as a side note, I think it's hilarious that Donald Trump Jr. talked to BitBoy last night. And I'm kind of glad in a way because Trump is so polarizing. So on Trump, you have him talking to BitBoy. Biden, they want to kill, you know, anything that uses energy because they have to make up for their Alaska pipeline decision, right? So they may come down harder on us with that dame tax and other things. And then you've got in the middle, like RFK trying to unite things and really trying to understand Bitcoin, who's also speaking at the conference, which I'm stoked about. I would love to like sit down if we could get like a small group with him and just like be, you know, supportive and have him show a united front as well. That'd be amazing. But yeah, I love that RFK is the one that's, you know, understanding Bitcoin. And the two other ones that I think most people in America are pretty sick of hearing from are they don't get it, right? So I actually really love that in this kind of battle that's coming up on the presidential side. I don't know. I think the odds are very much against RFK just because those, you know, two-party systems are so ingrained. But I think the more that we can, you know, support someone like that, even if it's like a Hail Mary philosophical, like we, you know, we understand this guy, we get this, I think that will make other candidates, you know, understand in the future that like we're to see just what a force we are. So that would be my thought on the presidential stuff coming up.
And final piece there is, yeah, it's important to think of these executive agencies and various departments as extensions of the administration's goals. Because yes, you know, these departments are supposed to have essentially decrees and, you know, goals that are non-political. That said, I think we can look at what it's supposed to be in theory, and we can also look at what it is in reality. And the commissioners or you know, chair people of these various agencies, they're presidential appointees most of the time. And, you know, that right there tells you that in many ways, they're going to be more aligned than not with what the administration is or how the administration is viewing a various issue or topic. And so when we're talking about, you know, the totally top-down approach of like, hey, go after the executive or start making this, you know, presidential issue, the primary reason is because, you know, whatever the White House's view of this issue is going to have a massive ripple effect across, you know, various different departments, which is what we've seen again, with, you know, the FDIC, the OCC, the Fed in many ways, as well as, you know, the SEC and the CFTC, and I could go on and on. But in any of the agencies that you've heard of, to Amanda's point, including the Office of Science and Technology Policy, there are the people on the ground, you know, doing the work, writing the reports. But let's just say that there are rounds of edits or reviews, you know, that those departments have to, you know, put things through. So like it or not, the administration kind of looms large over how this industry is going to be regulated.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And, you know, that's kind of a perfect transition. You guys already hit on it a little bit, but walk me through this administration's new proposed 30% tax on energy that's used for Bitcoin mining. And like, where did that come from? What's the likelihood that something like that actually passes kind of a divided House and Senate? And, you know, how soon would that kind of affect our industry?
Yeah, you want me to start here?
Yeah, Grant, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So high level, this digital asset, I believe it's called the Digital Asset Mining Excise Tax. And essentially what this is President Biden has a budget proposal for, you know, fiscal year 2024. And, you know, this happens every year, right? There's this massive budget and the administration basically has to figure out, all right, how am I going to make up for various shortfalls in revenue, you know, for this thing that underperformed last year? Or how am I going to make up revenue for this thing that I promised to spend money on? And so what you see with, or what we've seen, you know, with this current administration is, you know, they've invested quite a bit in, you know, things like the CHIPS Act or, you know, the infrastructure bill. And, you know, there's massive infrastructure investment in renewable energy. You can kind of go down the list. And this is totally agnostic of how you feel about that spending. This is just objectively, right? There's like the administration is spending money and they're looking around and trying to figure out, all right, where can we collect more revenue? And I think this is not the first time we've seen this, but there's, you know, certainly a view that, you know, the crypto industry doesn't get taxed its fair share, essentially, and that, you know, the government can make quite a bit of money from taxing this industry and help make up for some budget shortfalls. We don't need to get into all that, you know, at this point. But, you know, what, like, in terms of how this excise tax would actually work, essentially it would be phased in over 3 years. And so this would be a tax on any, you know, energy or electricity used for Bitcoin mining. And in the first year, it would be 10%. The second year, it would be 20%. The third year, it would be 30%, a 30% excise tax on electricity for mining. And what's interesting about this, and the thing that, you know, you've probably seen, if you've seen anybody talk about this, is it actually doesn't specify or differentiate between types of energy usage. So it's not saying, hey, we're going to tax you if you use coal or if you use natural gas or whatever energy that they're trying to stop, right? Like, they're just saying, we're going to tax you 30% on whatever electricity you use. And they cite, you know, environmental impacts. They cite Bitcoin miners leading to higher electricity costs for homes and various other things that I think many of us would at the very least disagree with some of the methodologies of how they've arrived at some of these conclusions. But all right, 30% excise tax, what does that do to the industry? That pretty much cripples the mining industry in the United States. There's really not, you know, much wiggle room there. I think talk to any miner and they'd tell you that, you know, a 30% impact on or increase in electricity costs would just crush, you know, operating expenditures. Because aside from Bitcoin, like the miners themselves, what is the primary cost for a Bitcoin mining operation? It's electricity, right? So we're talking the majority, but not, and I'm not like a mining expert. Go talk to a miner for the exact percentage of, you know, how much electricity makes up their operating expenditures. But it's the majority of their costs is going to electricity. So you're saying, hey, industry, we're going to increase your costs effectively, you know, double digits. Good luck surviving. And we know how competitive Bitcoin mining is. We know that those margins would be brutal. And so this is, in many ways, whether the industry knows it or not, or excuse me, whether the administration knows it or not, you know, an attempt to kill Bitcoin mining in the U.S. Now, let's back up, right? Where's this coming from? This is coming from the White House Council of Economic Advisors, right? The CEA. This is not like in law yet. This is not in a past, you know, like that. Nothing is passed here. This budget proposal is not passed. And so to the pragmatic, like, reality, is this going to pass? I think that in many ways depends on how loud the industry is and how many friends the industry has and how many folks in Congress actually understand, one, this industry and understand how this would impact the industry. And so it's really going to require, you know, folks like Amanda's group, who literally last week took a few dozen meetings, you know, on the Hill, talking to House and Senate offices about this industry. You know, I'm sure this topic came up as well. It requires that kind of boots on the ground approach. It requires, you know, all of the companies in this space joining those meetings and talking to various offices. And it requires that just like on the ground education. It requires the data. It requires a miner coming in and basically saying, hey, here's how this would impact our company. And here's what it would do to the industry. And like, you know, essentially do as you, they can either leave it up and say, do it as you please, or they can say, hey, I really urge you not to, you know, support this proposal. But to Amanda's point, not enough people have heard these stories. We eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff. It's important to remember that like lawmakers deal with literally hundreds, thousands of different issues, right? They don't have the bandwidth or all the time to fully understand how a 30% excise tax is going to impact the Bitcoin industry. They just don't. So they need actual stakeholders to come tell them what's up and really urge, you know, that they don't support this. And then if that happens, I do feel pretty confident that, you know, this can actually get, you know, left on the cutting room floor, because I do think there are enough, you know, allies, both, you know, moderate Democrats, you know, and folks on the right who recognize that, like, singling out a specific industry for electricity usage and not even being discriminatory over what type of electricity we're talking about, like, actually doesn't make the most sense and isn't necessarily fair or, you know, good for, like, competitive practices. And so this is one where I actually am cautiously optimistic that we can win out, but it's going to require, like, kind of a really full force effort from the industry. And to your earlier question, Brandon, who do you need to talk to? Every Bitcoin company should be, like, engaging with a lawmaker in some way, shape, or form. And that could even just be a letter, right? That could just be a letter saying one page, right? Hey, there's this excise tax. Here's what this would do to my company, right? And if you're a publicly traded company or you're a startup or anything in between, like, imagine hundreds of those letters coming to a congressional office. That's going to make an impact, right? Imagine following it up with a meeting from Amanda's group and my group. Like, that is the type of effort that we need here. And so I'm sorry, I've kind of rambled a little bit here, but this is urgent, you know?
Clarifying question too. So you basically said this, but just to clarify, like, Biden can't pass this as an executive order, right? Like, this has to be an act of Congress.
Yeah, this isn't a budget proposal. So, you know, Congress has to approve the budget.
Got it. And what's the value in this case? Like, I feel like it's valuable, but, you know, you tell me because I'm dumb, right? Tom Emmer, who is the majority whip in the House, right? Like, he's the one that whips the votes. Like, he doesn't want this to pass, surely. Like, that's got to be valuable to have him kind of on our team, right?
Yeah, it is. It's super valuable to have Emmer on our team. His office really gets this as well, as we can see. So he gets it and his office gets it, which is a nice combination that I hope we see more of. I think the odds are low, but that the odds are even possible is not, you know, is not great. So I agree with Grant. Like, we need to get every Bitcoin company should be coming out to DC. Like, for example, for the next, you know, we're running an experiment with Bitcoin Today Coalition and have a house out there so that folks, these Bitcoin companies, can come out and save money since we're in a bear market. So we've got extra room. So if you're, you know, working at a Bitcoin company and need a place to crash, so you only have to, you know, spend money on a flight and want to come out, we can, you know, we can house you and help set up meetings. So we're doing that through mid-June. So if anyone wants to come out, I think we have a small group of people coming out after Miami. The week after, we have some next week. So we're trying to make the most of this, you know, this timing, and especially before summer really kicks in and people get distracted, keep it, you know, tell our side of the story and build allies before summer.
Wow, that's a great offer. How do people get in contact about that?
Yeah, they can DM me, and we're not, you know, not like, not everyone that's like a random Twitter person, sorry, will be at the house, but like specifically Bitcoin companies. If you're working on Bitcoin, that offer is definitely open. We have, you know, 6 beds in a house, so save some money.
Yeah, totally.
And if you are a pleb, still write a letter, you know, still, I mean, yeah, feel free to reach out. We'll point you in the right direction, right? Like, see if you can talk to one of your, you know, state reps, if they'll talk to you, right? The industry, to my beginning point, right? You follow the money. I think it's a very powerful message coming from an industry saying, hey, we have, you know, thousands of jobs that we can offer. We have, you know, billions of dollars worth of, you know, revenue, worth of, you know, jobs that we can bring or keep to this country, you know, keep in this country. And, you know, here's how this tax would impact that. But that doesn't mean that, like, individual voices aren't, you know, valuable or important as well. It's just that I think the mining industry is really going to have to lead the charge here, because if they don't, we see stuff like this sneak through, you know, budget proposals all the time. Maybe not, you know, this egregious, but this is how these things work, right? There are literally thousands of these, you know, various, like, taxes or things kind of nestled in these budget proposals. And so it's important that we don't, you know, take it lightly. And I'm the first, by the way, to, like, caution against crying wolf. I think our industry has actually done, and broadly, like, I think our online community, right, Bitcoin Twitter, has been like led astray sometimes by certain loud voices who have like cried wolf over non-issues or small issues, right? And I think it's important to recognize like fatigue builds up quickly when it comes to policy, because policy can be so slow moving and sometimes it can feel so futile. And so if you're really going to like start to mobilize and make something an issue, one, you know, better get as much support as possible. And two, you better make sure it's worth the work, you know? And if people are kind of crying wolf over every little thing or some of these small issues, then I think it fatigues people for something like this, which is like, this is a real battle. This could be a legitimate win for the industry. Think about the infrastructure bill. Do you remember how big of a deal that was 18 months ago and how pissed off people were and how everybody was saying, you know, this could be the end of, you know, the crypto industry, as we know it in the United States, like crypto companies can't apply or can't comply, et cetera. And you saw how many people like, you know, got up in arms about that. And you saw that despite, you know, kind of all of that effort, the infrastructure bill still passed, you know, as it was written, and an amendment, you know, wasn't passed. And there's still like bad language there in the infrastructure bill. And so my point is like, this stuff is hard, and it's hard to get a legitimate like policy win. But this one actually has a pretty clear path if people kind of get their stuff together and get loud. Because, you know, to Amanda's point, these next 8 or 9 months or so are kind of like the last big opportunity for a little bit before election season, where being loud and focusing on education and making these relationships is actually like a viable solution. Because I'm telling you, in 12 months, it's pretty much only going to be about the money. it's pretty much only going to be about how much have you donated to a candidate's PAC or election campaign.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, on a local level, getting involved and going to these committee hearings and, you know, local's good, but you can't just hand that off, like, especially local. If you live there, you need to be the one showing up, right? So I've done a ton of stuff in Wyoming, moved there about 4 years ago, and it actually does work. And you get to know people on a one-on-one basis, where if I were to just trust, you know, the loud voices on Twitter to say these things, they would probably not have Bitcoin mining on their radar as a potential massive economic stream for Wyoming. Have they been able to figure it out with the public utilities? No, but now probably a couple dozen House and Senate members are aware on a local level. So we can all do that on a local level. I think the big thing at the national level, you know, and this is why Grant brings up the infrastructure bill. I think that's kind of we were doing a lot of education before that in a very informal way with a group of, you know, folks that work in Bitcoin for the year before that. And have that infrastructure bill is what I think, I don't want to speak for Grant, but I think it's what, you know, brought the Bitcoin Policy Institute about, and it's what brought the Bitcoin Today Coalition to a more formal, you know, C4, so that we can, you know, rally folks around this and raise money for an executive director and have someone have boots on the ground in DC as much as possible or all the time. And one thing that I would say that I really agree with Grant is there are, you know, this is politics. Politics is it's gross, right? It's really disgusting. I don't love spending time in DC. I would just caution that we are each very aware and use discretion when supporting, you know, folks that are out there ringing the policy bell, and be really, you know, mindful of your own time and energy and don't get fatigued. I really respect, you know, what Bitcoin Policy Institute puts out. We try to be very purposeful with, you know, the messages that we share and when we try to get folks behind things, rather than, you know, I don't really care about Twitter follower accounts. I'm like super stoked to delete it one day. So I think just understanding who the people are that are, you know, kind of doing this work behind the scenes and the difference between that and just making noise is really important, because we don't want to get fatigued. And that's a big concern of mine as well.
Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. You know, so there's two different directions I want to take this from here. The first one would be to zoom in a little bit more on the infrastructure bill. You know, we're starting to get close to, I guess, some of the kind of broad dates that were outlined in the infrastructure bill where some of these changes are going to happen. What's the latest? Like, are those still coming down the pipe? Is there still some outstanding legislation that's already been passed that needs to get amended ASAP for like wallet companies and you know, other folks?
And I have to run, Brandon and Grant, but thank you so much for having me. And sorry to bail on this important part.
All good. Thanks so much, Amanda.
See you, Amanda.
You're on the spot, Grant.
Yeah. So this is a great point, right? Because there was a bunch of like, I guess, ruckus, you know, around the infrastructure bill in 2021. And again, everybody was freaking out. And then it passed. And then there was a couple months where we were like, oh, you know, we can pass these amendments or we can get, you know, this, you know, XYZ. And then it went away, right? Which doesn't mean that it actually, like, the legislation itself went away. It just means that it disappeared from public consciousness because we, you know, are humans and we have, you know, impermeable, like, shiny object syndrome, and we're on to the next thing, right? It's like, oh, squirrel, right? Like, I'm going to go chase that squirrel now. But the reality is, like, this is, you know, this is very much, like, still an issue. And so, yeah, these were approved in November 2021, I believe it was. You know, the infrastructure bill that we talk about, the, you know, formerly the Infrastructure and Investment Jobs Act. And basically, this, you know, requires reporting for all, you know, cryptocurrency transactions that are over $10,000. And, you know, previously this only required, or this was only required for, you know, cash transactions, but, you know, now they're trying to apply it to cryptocurrency transactions. And, you know, just at a very high level, and you can go through and read, there's plenty of like really great stuff out there. So I'll spare you kind of the in-depth analysis here, but just high level, as you all know, due to things like nodes and miners and the various parties who are interacting with any given, you know, Bitcoin transaction, it doesn't necessarily make sense to force each of those parties to report, you know, anytime that they, you know, facilitate transaction over $10,000. It just doesn't like comply with, or it doesn't work with the way that we understand how something like Bitcoin works or some of these DeFi technologies or anything like that. And so all this is to say, yeah, that is like an expectation, you know, in this fiscal year, is that as of now, you are expected, like as of January of 2023, if you are taking part in a transaction that is over $10,000 in cryptocurrency, you are expected to report that transaction. The fact that most people don't really know that, I think, speaks to the inefficacy and kind of complete, I don't even know what word to use here. Basically, the language makes no sense. The legislation makes no sense. And the fact that people are being asked to comply with it, and that is like in law right now, and nobody even knows how to do it, I think tells you all you need to know about how that legislation works. But all that is to say, there's still like an amendment that is required. And pardon me, I don't have like, you know, the specific amendment in front of me. Just, you know, there are multiple, and we don't really lobby for like specific pieces of legislation at BPI. So I'm not going to tell you which one that, you know, you should support, but I can tell you, you know, the existing language is really flawed, and there are multiple proposals to fix it, but they've kind of fallen by the wayside because the ruckus has died down essentially. So what can we do? I mean, yeah, you could reignite like kind of conversations about the infrastructure bill and urge, you know, an amendment from some of the lawmakers who have already put out an existing amendment. We could also just kind of wait around and see what happens during this fiscal year and see if, you know, regulators just kind of realize, hey, this is a lost cause, and like, we can't actually enforce this because enforcement is the big issue here. So I wish I had kind of a better answer there, but wait and see is truly like, you know, what we're going to have to do, because we're 4 months into this. And I haven't heard of like anybody getting in trouble, you know, for not reporting it up to this point.
Yeah, that's interesting. And Zell, welcome to the stage as well. I know you got to kind of jump in and jump out, but, you know, we're talking infrastructure bill 18 months later, what's going on with it? And, you know, the thing that Grant said of like, you know, we may just have to wait and see what happens. is both, I guess, funny a little bit, but also terrifying, right? Because if basically every person and company that is sending transaction could be in non-compliance of this new law, doesn't that just open up the door for kind of targeted harassment from regulators, policymakers, lawmakers, et cetera? Like, what do you see coming down from this kind of infrastructure bill?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just hopping on the spaces, I don't know what Grant said, so I don't want to risk just repeating that. So I'll start by just kind of assuming that whatever Grant said, I probably agree with. You know, at this point, I think the interesting piece is, you know, the infrastructure's a sort of bill's ability to shed light on who Bitcoin's allies and adversaries are. You know, I think that when this first happened, you know, the plea of ignorance was a lot more reasonable. You know, this bill is thousands of pages. You've got this like single sort of section in one page pertaining to a niche tech policy issue, which is digital assets. And the manner in which that language really sort of like put a stranglehold on Bitcoin is like not immediately obvious. You'd have to be pretty familiar with how these technologies work to understand like what these kind of regulations actually entail in practice. Because I think when you look at the language as someone who doesn't know anything about Bitcoin, you know, it all might strike you as somewhat reasonable. Like, oh, these people that are, you know, quote unquote, effectuating a transaction should be, you know, subject to reporting requirements, you know, the same way that their legacy financial system counterparts should. And, you know, at first glance, someone might not realize that by the nature of Bitcoin's sort of inherent properties, that these perhaps like, you know, reasonable on face requirements are just like fundamentally untenable and are really just kind of a way of neutering the industry or, you know, worse. So at the time, the first reaction was, well, you know, for a lot of people, this may have just been like a genuine error. And I think that was part of the narrative that emerged after the infrastructure bill was, you know, the sort of mea culpas from people in Treasury, from people on the Hill that, oh, this isn't actually what we meant to do. We didn't understand. Well, now it's been a year and a half. And so we've seen, you know, a number of people move away from that sort of the broker definition language, from the sort of bad pieces of the infrastructure bill, which has been great. We've also seen people double down on it. And with the amount of like uproar and education, it would be impossible now to support that language and not know exactly what it actually means and what it does. So, you know, I'm not sure if Grant touched on that piece. So that's kind of my, I guess, like a sort of orthogonal take to the language of the infrastructure bill is, at this point, I think it's a useful sort of test to see who our allies are and see who Bitcoin's enemies are in Washington.
And really quickly, you nailed it, David. You know, Brandon, you mentioned Patrick McHenry is going to be speaking at the B23 conference in Miami in a couple weeks. And perfect segue, David, you know, talking about who our allies are. I believe Representative McHenry actually, you know, issued a letter to Secretary Yellen a few months back, like before the beginning of the year, basically saying, hey, you know, can you delay the enforcement of this provision until we actually know who this affects and until we can, you know, get more clarity on it? And so I think that is just a great example of someone who is, you know, both a champion of the industry, but actually, I think in many ways, more importantly, a champion on like principle, which is, hey, if we're going to have regulation, the regulation better make sense. It better do what we're expecting it to do. And it shouldn't have the ability to do more than that. And so in many ways, as much as we talk about, you know, finding champions for the industry, I think what's really great is, you know, not everybody has to like love Bitcoin. They just have to kind of stay true to certain principles. And more importantly, they just have to not kill it, right? And that is one of the great things that Bitcoin has going for it compared to a lot of these other, you know, Web3 or other crypto projects that you might find is like Bitcoin actually doesn't need really like positive legislation. We just need to avoid the negative legislation.
Yeah, Grant, on that note, I see that a lot of politicians that are speaking out against the 30% tax, they like to use the phrase Bitcoin and other crypto assets. What can be done to further educate that, you know, the other crypto assets are very different from Bitcoin and are actually fiat on steroids?
It's a great question. So shameless plug here. We just had the first, you know, annual Bitcoin Policy Summit in DC last week, so April 26th, and we hosted a one-day conference in Washington, DC that was all about what sets Bitcoin apart. And so we had a few hundred folks gather at the National Press Club, many policymakers. I think we had 20-something different congressional offices represented, you know, a Department of Treasury, SEC, Federal Reserve Board of Governors, CFTC, just a bunch of different, like, you know, government representatives there, a bunch of different congressional offices. And, you know, both Senator Lummis and Senator Cruz spoke at this event. And one of the coolest things that came out of the conference, and I didn't even realize it until until someone texted me about it after, because I just didn't register it in the moment. But I was speaking with Senator Lummis to close out the event during a fireside. And I asked her, I said, basically, hey, in the wake of FTX, many of your colleagues have retreated and are no longer talking about cryptocurrency issues publicly. And they used to be speaking at conferences. They're not anymore. They used to be getting quoted in articles. They're not anymore. How are you able to sit up here and speak at a Bitcoin policy summit when clearly everybody else, you know, or many other people kind of think this is toxic? And one of the things that was really cool is she started off her answer saying, essentially, like, when she started in Congress, she says Bitcoin was the Kleenex of cryptocurrency, where, you know, we use the term Kleenex to describe like tissue, but the reality is Kleenex is a brand. In the same way, people used Bitcoin to describe all of cryptocurrency, but they didn't actually understand that like Bitcoin was just one cryptocurrency. And she said, like, you can watch the video, it was super cool. She goes, like, thanks to you all, thanks to like talking about Bitcoin Policy Institute, we've actually been able to carve out a Bitcoin specific conversation in DC. And she's talking about how over time she's seen policymakers actually begin to differentiate between different types of cryptocurrencies. And so that was like, I mean, I don't know, maybe she was just saying that. But the cautiously optimistic part of me is looking at this and going, hey, we've all found our way here in some way, shape, or form. And some of us are younger than others. Some of us are older than others. Some of us have had like, just everybody in this space right now, think about it, has had a vastly different life experience. And they've somehow, we've all somehow kind of, we're in the same place right now. And we're talking about Bitcoin. And we're talking about Bitcoin as separate from the rest of the cryptocurrency industry. And I think in many ways, a lot of that just takes, it takes time. And everybody was met in their own different way and had to find this industry or technology in their own way. And so I think it requires like diligence and continued conversation. But more than anything, I think it requires time, because what you see is like, if you truly believe that our system is broken, then I think you will also believe that over time, those cracks will continue to show themselves, right? And some people are just looking a little bit more closely at the cracks right now. And I think at a certain point, you know, the glue will fail, or will fail more than it already has. And more people are going to understand why this technology is important. And so I guess to answer your question, it's time and it's continued diligence. And it, more than anything, it's patience. That's one of the things that this work has taught me, is as nice as it would be to, you know, tell people sometimes like you just don't get it or you're never going to get it. And that might be true with some people. Don't get me wrong. I think I've had to be incredibly patient with a lot of people who I've spoken with. And one of the coolest things of now having, you know, done policy specific work around Bitcoin for a couple of years now, is people who you talked to 2 years ago about this stuff sending you texts, you know, 2 years later telling you that they're running a Lightning node now. And 2 years ago, right, they thought Bitcoin's mining was like wasteful or something like that, right? Like that is the type of thing that actually gives me hope, is seeing over time more and more people start to get it.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the anecdote too. You know, I also want to shout out, we got Foss up here. So maybe I can give kind of a neat sort of tie-in here. You know, earlier you were talking, Grant, about the fact that kind of energy and chips were two factors with mining. And it kind of dawned on me, got me riled up. Maybe the coffee was hitting right at that moment, right? But, you know, in the macro sense, right? We've got a war with Russia, Ukraine, where, you know, energy production has been this weapon in that war. And then you've got tensions heating up with China, where chips are this kind of like underlying factor, like the chip supply chain. And here you have Bitcoin mining that is like a very reliable customer of both of those things, right? In the same time that the U.S. is trying to onshore, you know, good production and supply chains of both of those industries. And, you know, it kind of floors me to think that there would be any efforts right now to quell a domestic consumer of both of those kind of quote-unquote products. And so I'm curious, you know, is this just an epic fail in terms of, you know, our broad kind of policy direction? How do you see that kind of tying into the macro environment, Mr. Greg Foss?
Well, hi, Brandon. Grant, nice to hear from you. And Amanda is gone, but I'm a huge fan of Amanda's. So well done, all of you guys. Thanks for all the efforts you're putting in. I'm not sure if David is still on stage. It doesn't look like it, but I'm 60 years old and I can't really see my iPhone properly. So let's assume someone will tell David that I loved his comments as well. Look, the world is really moving in a lot of different directions right now, and offshoring supply chains has strategic implications, particularly in the chip industry. So let's not pretend that, you know, the chips that we've offshored that are producing ASICs, so application-specific integrated circuits for mining, are the ones we really care about. I mean, obviously, it'll be chips that are for defense purposes, national defense and weapons, etc. But trying to keep it within the Bitcoin mining ecosystem, something very interesting in my business is there are places where the cost of energy is actually negative, okay? And if you start focusing on that reality, I'll just throw one out, you know, actually converting flare gas into energy to mine Bitcoin, that's a subjective cost to the environment, flare gas, or if you don't even flare it, if you actually vent it, it's even more damaging to the ozone than flare gas. The point is, in nation states like Russia, there's no question you can argue that there's negative electricity costs or negative energy costs. And the same can be said of the Middle East, where flare gas is, that's where all the flare gas is in the world, is in the Middle East. But focusing on the United States, you know, you get these DAME initiatives that, you know, I'm not a huge fan of any taxation that's based on policy error, obviously. All of this to be said, my view is that over time, standalone Bitcoin mining that is on grid, if you will, is going away, okay? If you don't control your own source of energy, you're in big trouble as a Bitcoin miner anywhere in the world, because essentially you're hostage to a energy provider that can curtail you, they can tax you, they can change your rates, obviously. So I think over time, you'll see the Bitcoin mining business out of efficacy switch to the large utilities and even someday, in my best hope, the nuclear power industry. Because as everyone knows, powering up and down a nuclear reactor just is not possible, okay? You need demand response. You need to have load balancing. And Bitcoin is the most beautiful load balancer that there is in an antiquated grid. And that's what we have in North America. Don't forget, the grid started in Manhattan, and it's basically built off of that, okay? They strung wires between lampposts in Manhattan, and eventually they got all the way across the United States. No shit, people. It's put together with baling wire and masking tape. So don't try and overthink stuff. You got these politicians that can't put 2 + 2 together, so to try and teach them engineering, that's almost impossible. So I guess what I'll say is, I don't want to hog the stage. From a macro perspective, though, it becomes a necessity to get the utility experts to actually talk to Congress, in my opinion. Now, I'm a Canadian. I don't really understand how your political system works. And I know that money talks and bullshit walks. Okay. Well, money will talk in these PAC things. And I think that stands for Political Action Committee and all that stuff that makes America, well, maybe great and sometimes not so great. But I'm a huge fan of America. I need you guys to figure this out. Okay. It's that simple. And I think it was Grant who said, I'm not quite sure the word to call this. I'm going to give you the word from Canada. It's called a clusterfuck. Okay. You guys are operating in a clusterfuck. And it's really quite embarrassing when you see the free world, which is the United States, by the way, the last defender of freedom and democracy in the entire world, running around like a bunch of kindergarten kids that don't understand shit about fuck, and they're trying to make policy. Come on, get Amanda in there. Let's support these people like Grant. Get some education on the floor. And you know what? Donald Trump's son, look, maybe at least he's trying, but I'm really, really quite impressed with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but he's not perfect in a lot of ways either. Nobody is, especially me. So you said, you know, these loud voices on Twitter. Okay, sometimes I can be a loud voice on Twitter, and I do swear a little bit, although I made it through an interview the other day, 45 minutes on Kitco, without dropping the F-bomb. So I can do it. And here's what I want to say to people. Please do your research. Understand how beautiful a technology Bitcoin is from all perspectives. And that means store of value. That means load balancing on the grid. And it means, and yes, I'm going to say it, national defense. Okay, USA, please. God bless the United States. I'll see you guys in a week and a half. And I just have to say it again. Thanks very much for putting me up against Michael Saylor on Friday at 1 p.m. I'm going to kick his ass. There's going to be more people at my presentation than Michael Saylor's. Let's take odds on that. I know it's about a 0%. Nah, nothing's a 0% chance. How about a point, you know, 50 basis points chance that there's more people with ours? But I promise you, I'm going to tell the truth. Please, United States, I'm begging you, do the homework. Do the math for the children. Over to you guys. Thanks for having me upstage.
Thank you, man. You always galvanize me, so I really appreciate it. That was inspired. So, yeah, I mean, you know, to flip it back over to you, Grant, right? You know, Foss kind of outlined the maybe dysfunction that you're facing, the, you know, the way that we maybe don't have our best and brightest across the board in some of these seats. You know, is there an effort underway, or can, you know, can you walk us through maybe some of the different efforts that are really not even just educating who's there, but trying to, you know, get the right new people and fresh faces into DC who understand Bitcoin and can champion it from day one. What does that look like, especially as 2024 starts to loom?
Yeah, so there are two main ways that I'll outline here. One is what you all are probably pretty familiar with, which is, yeah, getting candidates elected. And the way that the Bitcoin community can support that is, you know, identifying various folks and various candidates, whether it's through primary elections or general elections, who they believe, you know, align with their values, and supporting them individually through campaigns, or supporting, you know, political action committees who are also supporting those candidates. And so there will likely be, in the 2024 election cycle, one or two or a few PACs that pop up around cryptocurrency issues. We're hoping one or two of those are around Bitcoin specific issues. And yeah, vote with your pocketbook, essentially, and show folks in DC that there's money here, and they can in turn show candidates that there is money here. And then yeah, once you help somebody get elected, they're going to be pretty partial to your cause, essentially, if they weren't already.
And Grant, may I also say there's brain power. Like, a lot of people actually do like hanging around with people who are smart. I hate to say it, but, you know, sometimes hanging around with the smart people actually brings more people to your political action committee or whatever you want to do. And there's no question that the Bitcoin community has what I believe to be the smartest people I have ever met. Now, it's not that they're all smart in the same sense, but, you know, Michael Saylor, I just can't say enough about how brilliant that man is. I can't say enough about how brilliant Jason Lowry is. I'm not sure if you guys all know who he is, but if you don't, I suggest you read his thesis presented to MIT. Whether or not you hate him because he works for the military or not, I suggest you try and open your mind. But then there's young kids like Dylan LeClaire, and certainly I'm missing people on stage at Bitcoin Magazine, not on stage rather, but at the Bitcoin Magazine group. This is a collection of some of the smartest minds I've ever seen. Now, I like to think I know what I know and I know what I don't know, but I have been to some of the top institutions in the world. McGill University as an engineer, rocket science, you're talking and walking amongst computer mainframes, okay? These people can't barely speak English, but they speak like math. That spews out of their mouth like Jaime the Robot. You guys are too young to remember who Jaime the Robot was on Get Smart. But the point is, you got engineers, you got Amanda, you got Natalie Brunel, you got, you know, women who are so brilliant at speaking and motivating. And then you have young kids who are 21 years old that knew way more than I knew and still know way more than I know. And they're in it. Yeah.
Just to punctuate your point and to embarrass Grant a little bit and give everyone in the audience a pit in their stomach. Grant, tell everyone how old you are and you've been working in DC for how long?
I'm 14 years old and I've been using a fake ID for my DC happy hours.
No. Yeah. But you are what? 23?
Oh man. I just got doxed.
Yeah. It's all good, buddy. It's all good because I'll dox myself. I'm 2¾ times as old as you. You know, that's 2 full turns plus 3/4 of a turn. So if you're trying to think on a carburetor, you guys don't even know what a carburetor is. You guys are so young, okay? Now you all have an electronic ignition on your cars. Go back and figure out what a carburetor was. It was a mechanical adjustment to mix fuel and air to go into an internal combustion. You had these fine-tuning valves. You don't turn them 2¾ times. You know, there's a little turn. That adjusts everything on a mechanical basis. Now everything's digital, okay? Everything's electronic ignition. The point is, guys, like these 23-year-olds, as much as I love what you're doing as well, you got to get a little bit of gray hair in the room, okay? Because cycles come and go over approximately 10-year periods, which means if you're 23, well, unless you started doing what you were doing when you were 13, you haven't even gone through one complete cycle, let alone more than 4. And I'm not building that up as anything more than it thickens your skin. It tells you how things actually work. History doesn't always repeat, but it sure does rhyme. Okay. And on that note, I'm going to sign off because why? I tend to hog the stage. Yeah, you guys are right. That's on my bingo card. But I'll also say this. I'm going to sign off because I really got to prepare for my talk that's going to compete against Michael Saylor on 2 weeks from today at 1 p.m. All right. And thank God for McShane who put me up against Saylor. I've never been so excited to compete against the king in my life. All right. Because I'm going to take on the king. I'm not going to win. But I promise you, the world will be a better place. Okay? Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks, Greg. You're going to crush it. And to that point, I love that we're talking about this theme of time. Because, Brandon, to go back to your initial question, how are we going to get, you know, fresh faces in D.C. and people who understand this? Yeah, one is we got to bring the people who have been studying this stuff and been in this space for a decade plus and get them in the rooms. And that's precisely what we've been trying to do at Bitcoin Policy Institute, right? I think my favorite thing about my work is that I'm surrounded by a bunch of people who are just way smarter than me and know way more than me about Bitcoin and a lot of other things as well. And the best thing that I'm able to do is I'm able to go into a room and say, don't listen to me, listen to the, you know, 14 expert fellows that we have, right? Some of them have been researching Bitcoin since like 2011, right? And they have peer-reviewed articles on this stuff. They have written books about this stuff, right? A few of our fellows are actually like, you know, they wrote a book about Bitcoin and they're releasing it, I believe, later this year. And so, you know, we just have this incredible, incredible accumulation of talent and brilliant minds. And to the second point that I was going to make of like, how do you get these people in DC and how do you get them to be the ones in the room? It is a bit cynical, but in many ways, like it starts with an institution like the Bitcoin Policy Institute. And that's not me just like shamelessly shilling my organization. That's just go look at every other, you know, big think tank in DC. Look at the Brookings Institution. Look at Cato. Look at Heritage. Look at any of these organizations. What are they doing? Essentially, they're building a pipeline of talent. And one of their main goals is in any given administration, they want one or two alum from those organizations to be part of a presidential cabinet or be an advisor to a president or advisor to an executive agency. And ultimately, like, if you want me to just give you kind of the behind the scenes, the inside baseball of like what BPI can do, is BPI can, Bitcoin Policy Institute can platform these voices, voices like Troy Cross, voices like Matthew Pines, voices like Margot Pies. I mean, I can go down the line. Like, if you haven't interacted with our fellows' work, I really think you're missing out. But these are the people that I'm really confident, whether it's this current administration, if they get reelected, you know, if Joe Biden gets reelected, or if it's the next administration, if he doesn't, I feel extremely confident that like these types of folks, the folks that are, you know, part of the Bitcoin Policy Institute, those are the people that we can platform and get in the room to ultimately be a policy advisor for the Office of Science and Technology Policy, or be an, you know, a policy advisor for, you know, one of these like banking institutions, whatever it is. I ultimately, you need to be there. You need to show up. And I think that's one thing our industry is like slowly learning to do, is just be there every day and show up. But you need that brain power that Greg was talking about, and really just need to show people that you're serious. And I think that's something our industry is like catching up on, and not necessarily to our, like, because we did it, but crypto has kind of shot everybody in the foot, and we're playing catch up now, trying to show no, we are serious. We have serious people who know what they're talking about. And those are the people who need to be in the room.
Yeah, you know, it actually reminds me of a little bit earlier this year when that Skull of Satoshi came out, and you know, you had like the whole Greenpeace thing going on. We were talking about like, okay, if we were going to do a debate, you know, with someone from Greenpeace, right? It's like, well, they wouldn't stand a chance against Bitcoiners debating them, even if we just had one person, because we can prep them with a world-class power markets expert, a world-class nuclear energy expert, a world-class, you know, grid stability expert, a world-class, you know, climate PhDs. I mean, the Bitcoin space is just filled with so many brilliant folks who love Bitcoin and bring their own expertise into the mix to help kind of make the market more, you know, anti-fragile and, you know, more decentralized, kind of intelligent. And so, you know, the thing maybe that, this is almost us like talking kind of back, you know, back in the napkin, right, Grant, is like, you guys have done a tremendous job of bringing these academics together. And I'm curious, like, you know, who's going to be the group that kind of starts finding the future people who could be representatives in DC? And like, you know, I'm sure they exist out there in kind of the Bitcoin community or the Bitcoin industry. And, you know, maybe it's time that they start doing their own campaigns and start running on kind of a Bitcoin platform. And I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are there, and whether you see kind of efforts like that in the wings.
You're asking who is going to identify pro-Bitcoin candidates in the 2024 cycle?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I can't speak to too many specifics just yet, because there are some organizations in DC that we know are working on things like this. And I want to respect I want to respect their privacy and the things that they have going on. But I'll just, everybody on this spaces, you're hearing a little bit of, you know, insider info. It's coming. There are allies in DC who are currently like working on Bitcoin focused, not just advocacy, but Bitcoin focused political spending for the 2024 campaign cycle. And so, as a little teaser, right, and slightly tangentially, but last week we announced BPI Action in partnership with former Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat out of Ohio, and former Congressman David McIntosh, Republican House member. And what's interesting about this is like, we're starting to build a bipartisan coalition of people and groups in Washington, D.C. who are in support of the Bitcoin industry. And this is the first step toward essentially getting them to take this stuff seriously on an election basis. And so I will spare the juicy details right now because, you know, I don't want I don't want these people in DC to be mad at me being like, hey, you spilled the beans. You told people about what we're doing before, you know, we officially filed our papers, you know, with the election commission and all that jazz. But like, just know it's coming. And when you hear about it, just think back to this space and be like, oh yeah, Grant told me this was going to happen. So as I've been with this entire space, I'm cautiously optimistic. And it's incredibly exciting that like, it's not just, and by the way, the last thing I'll say is, it's not just crypto people this time. The last election, it was like crypto folks like SBF and some of his, you know, gang. And then some other folks, like they started some PACs and spent a lot of money. And it was like just crypto people. And that's okay. That was cool. That was a good first step, whatever, regardless of how you feel about like, actually, I know how everybody feels about the FTX situation. But like that was the first sign that the crypto industry was actually going to spend money in elections. I'm just saying in 2024, we're actually going to see some legacy DC institutions get involved with like serious campaign spending around Bitcoin specific issues. And so that is actually like, you want to talk about kind of seismic shifts. That's something that we have not seen up to this point. We have not seen non-Bitcoin native organizations really take a step up. And so I'm really, really excited about that for next year when we see legacy DC institutions, really, really powerful people who are change makers get serious about this stuff. And you're already seeing that, right? With RFK Jr., right? Like you're seeing that from the candidate side. Serious candidates take this technology seriously from a policy platform. You're seeing it with Senator Lummis, Senator Cruz. You're seeing this with some Democratic folks as well on the House side. But you're going to start to see this from like the DC operative side. And that's where the people who are pulling the strings, I guess, are starting to take this really seriously.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely gives me hope. That gives me hope that, you know, maybe the Overton window can shift on the conversation, especially around Bitcoin. You know, I guess to the defense of the Bitcoin kind of industry, the Bitcoin-focused industry, you know, all these crypto people, they were able to print a token and then basically sell it and use the money to support candidates. And it was quick and easy money. And obviously,
genius.
Yeah. It blew up in their face in the end, right? Bitcoin, you know, the Bitcoin industry, you have to be creating products and services that people actually use, that people, you know, there's actual revenue, there's actual sustainable business models built into it. And then as it grows, you can start looking at kind of different ways to try and influence policy. And so, you know, that's how an industry works, believe it or not. You can't just print the token and get what you want. You got to actually build the industry and build the products people want. And so, you know, it's exciting. It's growth. I mean, it's true growth in the Bitcoin industry. And, you know, it's exciting to kind of see that, you know, now that the growth has come, especially to the US, especially after China banned Bitcoin mining and you saw all these Bitcoin miners move here. It's like, well, now we've got influence. Now we've got, you know, a platform we can start building and we can start shaping the way that, you know, policy in the US needs to work around Bitcoin. So it is exciting. And, you know, as Bitcoin adoption grows in the U.S. broadly, as more people use it, as more people find it as a tool in their everyday kind of lives financially, the more influence that kind of the Bitcoin industry and community has. So, yeah, the long-term trend is very bullish. And you know, you got to credit the folks like you who've kind of been boots on the ground for the past few years and just really trying to, you know, protect the industry from just getting regulated out of America, to be blunt. So yeah, just major shout out and bullish on the future.
Appreciate you. Are we coming up against time?
Yeah, so I'll look to my co-hosts up here. I don't have too much more in terms of questions, but I know I've kind of been hogging. So I don't know if we want to wrap here. I don't know if we want to dive into some other topics.
I also don't have any more questions. Grant, thank you so much. Brendan, also thank you for all the good questions and good conversation. Unless you have any, you know, parting thoughts, we are all so, so busy with the conference that's coming up in less than 2 weeks. So would like to wrap up sooner than later.
Yeah, Brendan. You know, a quick plug, I guess, and Grant, I'll throw it back to you. But the conference is happening. It's coming right around the corner. We just announced, you know, yesterday or maybe 2 days ago. I don't know. It all runs together in my head now. RFK, presidential candidate, is going to be speaking at the event. And then while we were on this Twitter space, you may have seen, we just announced Vivek, and I'm going to butcher his last name, but Vivek, who is a Republican presidential candidate, kind of in the libertarian camp, who's also very pro-Bitcoin, and he will also be speaking at the event. So crazy to think that we have crossed some Rubicon where multiple presidential candidates are coming to a Bitcoin conference to talk about Bitcoin. I mean, it's crazy to think about, and it's exciting for, you know, the industry that we have incepted the Bitcoin conversation into the broader kind of consciousness of you know, liberty and America and how, you know, systems, economic systems should work. And so, you know, the future is really bright, and I'm very excited to kind of hear from them, excited to hear from some of the other political folks we talked about up here between, you know, Patrick McHenry, who again is the head of the Financial Services Committee. He is Gary Gensler's boss, among other people. We have, of course, Senator Lummis, the you know, staunchest, most pro-Bitcoin person in D.C. today, and a lot of other people who are, you know, movers and shakers behind the scenes. So, you know, the Washington, D.C. angle for Bitcoin is going to continue to kind of be a part of the narrative. And, you know, you don't have to, you can opt out. You know, Bitcoin's all about making your own choices, and you don't have to pay attention to it, but to the people who are paying attention and the people who are building and changing, you know, things in the space and making progress, you know, it's happening, and it's going to be good for Bitcoin.
Yeah, Grant, did you want to add anything to that?
Oh, no. Yeah, you crushed it. I'm unbelievably pumped for this conference. Can't wait to see you all there. Seriously, my DMs are open if you want to chat about anything policy in the meantime. Thank you so much to BM, the conference team. Thank you, Brandon. Appreciate y'all having me on here. And I'm not as good as Greg at like hyping up my panels. I'm sorry. I wish I could get up here and tell you that I'm going to, like, you know, I have a 0.5% chance of beating out Saylor in terms of attendance. That's probably not true, you know, but you know, that's okay. So I hope that if you enjoyed this space, you know, you enjoy whatever else happens at the conference. And the good news is, like, as I said about BPI, everybody there is smarter than me. I'm sure a bunch of people at the conference are smarter than me and more interesting than me as well. So, you know, if you come to my panel and hate it, there's going to be plenty of other good content for you to listen to, and a bunch of other cool people for you to meet. So thank you so much for having me, everybody. Thanks so much for listening and for continuing to support our work. Seriously, the outpouring of support after during and after the Bitcoin Policy Summit was one of the coolest things that I've ever experienced. It was one of the proudest moments of my life. Just seeing, like, the fact that you all are sitting here on a Friday morning hearing about the work that we're doing, and it means the world. And I've been saying this a lot lately, but I just feel immense gratitude for being able to work in this space, work alongside people like you all, and truly, like, be able to fight for something that I believe in. Because the more I talk to people and the more you experience things, I think it becomes increasingly apparent that it's very rare for people to be able to spend this much time and energy and effort on something that they truly believe in. So I feel very lucky, and I appreciate everybody's support here.
Yeah, Grant, thank you so much for the work that you do. We're really, really honored, actually, to have you and to have had Amanda and Greg and Brandon. Thanks a lot, everyone. All right, so we'll see you all, hopefully, in less than 2 weeks in Miami.
See you guys.
Bye.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLive to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.